It's time now for movie critic Bob Mondello's latest home video recommendation. With so many big movies crowding the multiplex, Bob is looking back more than half a century to a movie that makes most of today's blockbusters look painfully small. And if the whistling didn't give it away, it's a collector's edition of my favorite movie, The Bridge on the River Kwai.
British prisoners of war in a Japanese labor camp, building one magnificent railroad bridge, the best that British engineering and director David Lean's production crew can manage. Alec Guinness is the commanding officer, so intent on preserving his troops' morale that as the camp's doctor tries to tell him, he's blind to the practical implications of what they're doing.
Sir, are you convinced that building this bridge is a good idea?
Are you serious?
Yes, sir.
You don't agree that the men's morale is high, that discipline has been restored, that their condition has been improved?
What we're doing could be construed as, forgive me, sir, collaboration with the enemy. Perhaps even as treasonable activity.
Are you all right, Clifton?
Fortunately, William Holden is also on hand, preaching common sense.
You've seen the graveyard. To give up hope of escape, to even stop thinking about it, is like accepting a death sentence.
The fictional story David Lean told in 1957 is based on the building of the Burma Railroad, which cost tens of thousands of laborers their lives during World War II. Details of the real events are contained in a River Kwai extra, sort of a historical primer that you can play along with the film. And there's a documentary with details of building that bridge.
It's going to be a proper bridge.
The largest movie set ever created to that time, according to the filmmakers. And in 1957, you had to actually build the thing, not drop it in digitally. There's also the story of a failed first attempt to blow up the bridge when the train, instead of plunging into the river, zoomed straight across and derailed in the jungle. And this story of how the crew captured a spectacular scene of birds in flight.
And I had some men posted around to fire rifles to get them bloody things to come out of the trees. And when they came out, there were thousands of them. It blotted out the sun. It was a phenomenal sight. But they started to piss. And it was like hot, stinking rain falling all over us. Don't see that in the movie.
No, you don't. What you do see is what nearly everyone agrees is one of the screen's great epics. I'm Bob Mondello.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was created last year to give consumers more tools to protect their money, but now some Republicans in Congress are saying the agency has too much power. We'll talk about that in a moment. But first, we have another in our series marking Father's Day, which is this Sunday. We're celebrating dads all week with essays by some of our contributors and guests from a variety of backgrounds, a married dad, a going-it-alone dad, a dad who chose to adopt. They're all expressing the joys and challenges of fatherhood. Today, we hear from Feramej Meshkinpour, an engineer who made America his home when his children were very young.
In 1987, I emigrated to United States with my wife and my two young daughters. At that time, I felt like I was traveling into a dark tunnel with no money and no idea what the future would hold. In Iran, I was an engineer with a master's degree, but I did not have confidence in myself. In the U.S., I had to somehow motivate myself to make a life for my family, despite the pain and fear. I thought of myself as a captain of the ship, and it was my duty to lead my family to safety, to not let the ship sink. To work as an engineer here, I needed to go back to school, but in order to feed my family, I need a job right away. I started working at El Pollo Loco, a fast food restaurant, for $3.25 an hour. For the next 10 years, I worked without taking any weekends off or any vacations, sometimes working two shifts a day. I remember when my father-in-law came to visit us from Iran, I had started a plumbing business out of our garage. One day, he rode with me to a job. He sat in the truck while I put on my coverall and crawled under the house to fix something. Hours later, when I crawled back out, dirt all over my body. He looked at me and he started to cry. Now, more than 20 years later, I wish my father-in-law were alive to see how things have changed. I have two beautiful grown daughters. They have both graduated from the best college in the country, and I'm so proud of them. I'm still running my plumbing business, but thankfully there is no more dirty work, no more work on weekends. My wife drives a luxury car and has more leisure time to garden and watch tennis on TV. I am happiest when my wife and my two daughters are around me. I still feel like I am steering a ship, but we have reached a much safer place.
That was Farah Maj Meshkinpour. He's an engineer and entrepreneur who immigrated to America from Iran, reflecting on Father's Day. He's also the dad of one of the producers of this program, Sanaj Meshkinpour.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. For decades, social scientists have tried to determine how TV ads affect the children and teenagers who watch them. Do commercials make kids more materialistic? Are fast food ads responsible for rising childhood obesity rates? Well, youth radio reporter Maya Cueva looked for answers inside her own brain.
Here I am at Walgreens in the hair product aisle. There are a lot of brand name shampoos on the shelf, but there's one that always catches my eye.
For stylized curls that look like a splurge at a price that feels like a steal. Tresemme Flawless Curls.
I've probably seen this ad 100 times and didn't think it could affect me. Not after all my mom has taught me about never surrendering to the manipulative ways of advertising.
I realized that kids were living in a whole nother world that was influencing them more than I was.
My mom's a therapist. When I was in second grade, she started an after-school class where she had kids analyze TV shows and commercials.
And the kids were used to just going into that zone where you just kind of stop thinking and you just watch. And so this interrupted that and made people stop watching and start thinking.
But recently, I've been wondering just how much control I have over my own thoughts when it comes to ads, which is how I found myself in a Berkeley lab with a hat of electrodes on my head.
So this is called an EEG cap. I'm going to place one of these caps on your head.
Okay.
Well, it looks like a swim cap. And then there's like a wire attached to my nose.
I'm in the corporate headquarters of Neurofocus, a pioneer in the business of neuromarketing. It makes some scientists antsy, but the company claims to tell advertisers how to make better commercials by replacing focus groups with an electroencephalogram. Kind of like how a microphone is picking up the sound waves of my voice, the EEG strapped to my head is picking up brain waves created by the electrical activity that passes between neurons when my brain processes something. Anything. Even commercials. Like this one Neurofocus uses to demo their technology.
The Olympic Winter Games will always be where history happens.
As Morgan Freeman's godlike voice narrates, I watch images of a torch lighting ceremony, a figure skater, hockey players. Meanwhile, in a neighboring control room, lab director Mark Kishiyama shows my producer a series of squiggly waves that appear on a screen.
This is her brain activity right now, real time.
Visa, the only card accepted at the Olympic Games.
When you're watching ads and so forth, you know, you're kind of sitting there and you're kind of passively watching it, but your brain is responding to it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not always conscious. It's not conscious that you're...
Subconscious.
It is, or as we say non-conscious, but the awareness is still there.
That awareness shows up on the EEG as tall peaks in the parts of my brain Kishiyama says are associated with emotion, attention, and memory. Those parts get busy at certain moments in the ad. At the beginning with the torch and figure skater, and then later when a Visa card appears on screen. He says it's evidence that my brain is making a non-conscious link between the credit card and the Olympics.
You think that a 30-second ad is so fast none of it's going to get in, but it does, you know, as you can see.
So scary.
But it does show how effective it is.
Advertisers will use Kishiyama's data on the most effective moments in an ad to compress it down to a 10-second web video for sites like YouTube. In theory, you'd see a lot more brainwave peaks per second as they pack this message into your head. But what happens once it's in there? Ben Hayden is a neuroscientist who studies decision-making. He told me about researchers at Caltech who scan the brains of people on diets while offering them junk food.
And you can literally witness this battle going on.
A certain region of the brain lit up when the dieters resisted the junk food. Hayden says that self-control region is in a tug of war with the parts of the brain affected by ads.
When advertising comes into the picture, it kind of is the opposite of self-control. It encourages you to go, just go out and buy it, just do it.
If he scanned my brain while I was in that shampoo aisle, Hayden says he would see lots of activity in the just do it region as I grabbed the Tresemme. But just as TV ads prime that part of the brain, it turns out the kind of training my mom gave me could boost the signal in the just say no region. It's what mom was telling me all along.
So I wouldn't worry so much about whether your brain will react. It's more what decisions you make after your brain reacts.
So you think that I still could consciously not buy the product? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I think so, because I know how thoughtful you are and how well-educated you are about this.
Okay, so maybe my mom's biased, but there's some neuroscience to back her up. Hayden says I could be better off than most teens because every time I think critically about how ads work, I create new patterns in my brain that strengthen the self-control regions. The ads might get inside my brain, but they don't have to decide what I do. For NPR News, I'm Maya Cueva.
Our story was produced by Youth Radio.
Now to a conversation about personal finance, especially about keeping our money safe. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or CFPB, opens for business next month. This new government agency was created by lawmakers in the wake of the financial crisis. The CFPB's objective is to create and enforce federal consumer financial protection laws, as well as to promote financial education for consumers. But lawmakers are still squaring off over how the agency should be run and how much power it should have. We wanted to know how this debate over the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's power could affect consumers, so we've called upon NPR business reporter Tamara Keith and a regular contributor on matters of personal finance and the economy, our money coach Alvin Hall. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Tamara, why don't you start by telling us what kinds of problems lawmakers hoped the CFPB would solve?
Well, think mortgages here. Remember, as the housing bubble was inflating, there were some crazy mortgages out there. We had 228s and exploding arms and interest only and subprime loans going to people with perfectly good credit. The paperwork was confusing. People didn't know what they were signing. And now we have this rampant foreclosure problem that's still going on. The idea of the CFPB is to improve the clarity, to make it easier for people to understand what they're getting into, not just with mortgages, but with all kinds of financial products. And also, it basically to be a cop on the beat for consumers. The primary job will be to look out for consumers and consumers first, looking for unfair, deceptive, abusive practices.
So why is there so much opposition to that? That seems like that would be a fairly simple proposition. I mean, there's an FDA to protect consumers and food safety. Why is this so controversial?
Well, I would say that the controversy in some ways has been settled in that this agency was created through legislation. That has been settled. The financial industry, the people who have opposed it in the past are saying, yes, okay, we know this is going to happen. We know this needs to happen. They've changed their tactics now. And the new discussion is about how much power it should have and how much independence it should have. And there are real concerns out there being expressed by the business community, the financial industry, and primarily by Republicans in Congress saying, you know, this is too independent. It shouldn't have just a single director. It should have a commission like other organizations and other things like that, that it shouldn't have unlimited budget powers.
Does it?
Not exactly. It does have fairly broad budget powers, but there are limits to it. This is one of those things where the left and the right are looking at the same thing and seeing it very, very differently.
Now, Harvard professor Elizabeth Warren has been tapped as a special advisor to the president to set up the agency, but she hasn't actually been nominated to run it. and really nobody's been nominated to run it to this point. So why has she become such a lightning rod? Is it really about her, or is it really about the structure of the agency?
Well, she has always been a lightning rod. She has been a lightning rod for years. Consumer groups love her. She's incredibly articulate about the needs of consumers. The financial industry and business groups are scared of her in some ways. They won't say that out front, but you know, in background conversations that I've had with folks, they say they're concerned that maybe she doesn't fully understand their industries and that there could be unintended consequences.
Evan, you're in New York and you've worked on Wall Street and you've obviously followed the issues pertaining to consumers very closely. So what's your take on this?
I think that the industry is afraid of her, as they're always afraid of any new change. And they argue that this change will have unintended consequences. Well, all change does. But clearly, given what has happened in the past, consumers do need protection. You look at simple things like credit card statements. They're very difficult to understand for the average person. And they always contain these little bitty clauses that put a lot of the power in the hand of the lender. People need to be made aware of what they sign and all the details in simple, straightforward language.
From your perspective, Alvin, as a person who's been working in financial education for some time, and
yes,
you also train people, what are some of the issues that you think that this new agency should address immediately?
It needs to make sure that all of the lending statements are in clear, straightforward language, that the key points are highlighted, and that the people who are selling this product are able to explain this information to people, to the borrowers, in very clear terms.
But on the other hand, Alvin, over the past couple of years, lawmakers have already enacted new legislation to protect consumers. There's the CARD Act, which,
yes,
was designed to rein in excessive interest rates on credit cards. The Federal Reserve wrote new rules limiting overdraft fees on debit card purchases. So there have already been moves to, well, advocates would say, level the playing field for consumers. So what else does this agency need to do?
It needs to go in and make sure that when new products are created or new lenders or new people involved in the system come about, that they do not seek to exploit the public.
Now, there are a number of Republican bills, Tamara, in Congress that would reshape the agency. Among the proposals, the agency would be run by a board of directors rather than a single person, that Congress would control the budget. And so do any of these proposals have any steam behind them?
I don't think that there is anything that is actually going to make it through the Senate, which is controlled by Democrats, and certainly won't get signed by the president. However, there is something interesting happening in the Senate. 44 Senate Republicans signed a letter saying they would not confirm any nominee, not just Elizabeth Warren, any nominee to be the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau unless these changes are put into place.
Which changes specifically? The ones I just described?
Yeah, exactly.
So they're saying that they're taking a tough stance on appointing anybody to that agency. So final question to you, Tamara. If the agency is supposed to be created, be born next month,
go
live next month, how is it going to operate if there's no director and if there's still so much disagreement about how it is supposed to function?
Well, it won't be fully functional. That's the thing. It is currently housed in the Treasury Department. It will stay in the Treasury Department instead of becoming more independent. It will gain some new powers, but it won't gain some of the very powers that Alvin's been talking about. It won't be able to write new rules to prohibit unfair and deceptive practices. It won't be able to set up these new disclosure forms for credit cards or for mortgages. So a lot of the things that it was designed to do, it won't be able to do without a director.
Tamara Keith is a business reporter for NPR. She joined us here in our studios in Washington, D.C. Alvin Hall is our regular contributor on matters of personal finance and the economy. He joined us from our bureau in New York. Alvin, Tamara, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The Obama administration is increasing pressure on Congress to overhaul the No Child Left Behind law. Education Secretary Arne Duncan has called the law a slow-motion train wreck that will soon force good schools to be labeled as failing. And he's warning that if Congress does not act, the administration will move forward on its own. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, the reaction to Secretary Duncan's effort shows how divided Congress is on how to fix the law.
Secretary Duncan has been scheduling appearances all this week to drive home one single point. we desperately want Congress to reauthorize. But if they don't, we need to think about what we can do to provide states that are really driving reform, flexibility to move forward and not have them get crushed by the current law.
Crushed because Duncan says as many as 80% of the nation's schools will fail to meet federal requirements for student test scores. That would lead to sanctions that Duncan says would punish states that are making good faith efforts towards improving student achievement. To address the problem and to goad Congress into action, Duncan says he'll cut some slack to deserving states.
If states are acting in bad faith, we don't play ball with them. States are acting in good faith and, you know, driving reform and doing the right thing by children and teachers and principals, then we want to work with them.
The reaction to this idea helps explain why Congress has not been able to update No Child Left Behind. For Republicans, there is strong suspicion that the administration is holding a gun to the head of Congress. Pass our idea of education reform or we'll accomplish the same goal without you by granting waivers. Congressman John Klein of Minnesota chairs the House Education Committee.
He can decide those policies that he favors. Tell recipient of the waiver, if you'll do what I want you to do, you can have this waiver.
Klein says that's what happened with the administration's signature reform initiative, Race to the Top.
When they granted to the secretary $5 billion and said, go do good things for education, which were completely under the purview of the Secretary of Education with no congressional input.
Chairman Klein says No Child Left Behind should be broken into pieces and reformed that way. Secretary Duncan says no way. NCLB needs to be swallowed in a giant bipartisan mouthful, just as it was when it was enacted nearly a decade ago. Margaret Spellings, Education Secretary under President Bush, says the problem is that the bipartisan agreement of 2001 is gone.
What's unique is not that we're stalled at the moment. What's unique is that we passed the darn thing in the first place.
Spellings says gridlock is tougher to break now because the House Education Committee is in new hands. Many of its newest members are freshman Republicans who are deeply skeptical of the federal role in education. Now, if Duncan feels the only alternative to congressional action is to grant waivers from the law, some warn that could open the floodgates for states to hide lousy performance. Democratic Congressman George Miller of the House Education Committee says he constantly hears from schools that want a break because certain groups of students can't perform at grade level.
Want relief for students with disabilities, want relief for performance in a difficult school, want relief in a school that's been merged with another school. I mean, there's no end to the reasons why relief should be granted, but those are years and months and opportunities in a child's life.
Kansas asked for a waiver from No Child Left Behind earlier this year and was denied. Now Kansas says it may return to ask once again for relief. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Last year, the English newspaper The Observer asked comedian Steve Coogan to travel in the English countryside and review six acclaimed restaurants. Coogan invited along his friend Rob Brydon, also a comic. Because both men are stars in Britain and have a cult following in the U.S., their journey was turned into a six-part BBC series directed by Michael Winterbottom. That series has been edited into a feature film called The Trip. Our critic at large, John Powers, has seen it and says it not only made him laugh out loud, but got him thinking about the way movies have changed.
A few nights ago, I put on Warner Home Video's new Blu-ray of one of my favorite adventure films, The Man Who Would Be King. Based on a story by Kipling, this 1975 tale stars Michael Caine and Sean Connery as two roguish British soldiers who scam their way into taking over the country of Kafiristan. It's a terrific movie, and as it unfolded, I was struck that Caine and Connery have been part of my life since I was a kid. I could recognize their voices in my sleep. I'm hardly the only one. I was reminded of this when I saw The Trip, a hilarious new road movie starring two brilliant comics. One is Welshman Rob Brydon, whose vocal trick called Small Man in a Box is itself worth the price of admission. The other is Steve Coogan, an Englishman best known here for minor roles in movies like Tropic Thunder, but worshipped in Britain for creating Alan Partridge, an inept talk show host who's the hero of some of the funniest TV shows of all time. The Trip has no plot. It's just Coogan and Brydon driving around northern England eating at posh restaurants, mocking foodieism, and trying to one-up each other. Nowhere are they more competitive than in their dueling impersonations of the British actors they grew up with, Caine and Connery. Here, Brydon does the aging Caine, and Coogan tries to top him.
Right, so, Michael Caine's voice now in the Batman movies and in Harry Brown. I can't go fast because Michael Caine talks very, very slowly.
Right, this is how Michael Caine speaks. Michael Caine speaks to his nose like that. He gets very, very specific. It's very like that. When he gets loudly, it gets very loud indeed. It gets very specific. It's not quite nasal enough the way you're doing it, all right? You're not doing it the way he speaks. You're not doing it with the kind of... And you don't do the broken voice when he gets very emotional. When he gets very emotional indeed. She was only 16 years old. She was only 16. You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off. That's Michael Caine.
Now, in a way, the trip is terribly up to date. In having Coogan and Bryden play heightened versions of themselves, it works the same fiction versus reality turf as the books of W.G. Sebald or shows like Jersey Shore. Yet what makes the movie a blast could hardly be more old-fashioned. The trip harks back to when movies, still not far removed from vaudeville, showcase stars who were able to do acts. Chaplin and Keaton's immaculately tooled slapstick, Astaire and Rogers' ethereal gliding, or poor doomed Judy Garland singing audiences over the rainbow. Of course, mimicry is not the world's most exalted talent, but I would cheerfully spend a whole night watching Bryden and Coogan do their warring James Bonds. This isn't simply because I'm myself the world's worst mimic. I once reduced my sister Becky to hysterics with my hapless Howard Cosell, perhaps the all-time easiest person to impersonate. It's because good mimicry is kissed with the uncanny. Whether it's Tina Fey doing Sarah Palin or Jimmy Fallon's Neil Young, we hear the right voice coming from the wrong body. And in the process, we're shown something revelatory about the person being mimicked. The trip got me to thinking about which of today's movie voices I can instantly hear in my mind's ear. Woody Allen, Clint Eastwood, Morgan Freeman. Which is to say, old guys like Connery and Caine. As for the young ones, can you hear Brad Pitt's voice right now? Or Angelina Jolie's? This year's Oscar winner Natalie Portman is a superb actress, but I can't remember what she sounds like as I can with Betty Davis, Lucille Ball, or Marilyn Monroe. Some of this is because movie stardom has changed. Hollywood once promoted stars whose selling point was a persona, an individualized, even eccentric style that played to working-class adults. Such style meant having trademark voices, accents, and locutions that instantly called up a whole universe of feeling, from Mae West's lewd growl to Jimmy Stewart's homespun decency. I told you I was a terrible mimic. In contrast, today's stars either work in movies for middle-class teens, where conformity is largely the rule, or take pride in being chameleons. Daniel Day-Lewis and Meryl Streep don't want to sound like themselves. That said, the major reason I can imagine Katharine Hepburn's voice, but not, say, Katherine Heigl's, is simple longevity. Today's stars have shorter shelf lives. Just ask Kevin Costner. Still, I can well imagine that 25 years from now, there will be another movie in which comics sit around the table and swap their impressions of grizzled old stars like George Clooney, Denzel Washington, and Leonardo DiCaprio. And if there is, I can promise you one thing. I'll pay to see it.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. You can see clips from the trip on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. Our show was directed today by Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.